This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's great to be back in New York after a week of reporting in Puerto Rico. We begin this hour with new allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Just as a date was set for Christine Blasey Ford to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee, The New Yorker magazine came out with a second allegation against the judge. And a warning, this segment will contain some graphic content. The piece from Jane Mayer and Ronan Farrow claims that Deborah Ramirez recalls being at a party as a freshman at Yale University with Kavanaugh. And according to Ramirez, they were both drinking when Kavanaugh exposed himself and thrust his penis in her face. Other students called for her to kiss it. She says she was mortified and pushed him away.
She remembers vividly Brett Kavanaugh laughing at her during this incident, pulling his pants up afterwards.
That was Farrow speaking on CNN today. Deborah Ramirez is now calling for an FBI investigation. Kavanaugh himself denies the incident, and in a statement he wrote, quote, "The alleged event from 35 years ago did not happen. The people who knew me then and know that this did not happen and have said so. This is a smear, plain and simple. I look forward to testifying on Thursday about the truth and defending my good name and the reputation for character and integrity I have spent a lifetime building against these last-minute allegations." With us now is Karin Demirjian, a congressional reporter for The Washington Post. Hi, Karin.
Hi, good to be with you.
Lots to unpack here today. Let's start briefly with the Deborah Ramirez story in The New Yorker, because she says that she and other students were drunk. And while she admits this and says that there may have been some gaps in her memory, she's pretty confident in her claims. What's been the response in Washington?
Well, the response has been that it's basically taken what seemed like a done deal, that we were going to get to Thursday and hear from Christine Blasey Ford and from Kavanaugh about those allegations, back to kind of square one, because now there's new allegations. And so it's Senate Democrats are saying, hold up, we've got to stop everything. We can't be just doing Thursday and go to a confirmation vote. We need time to investigate the allegations, the new ones that have come to light. And of course, Republicans have kind of wanted to push through this the whole way to be able to get to a confirmation vote for Kavanaugh. The more time this takes, the more people that come out with allegations, the more complicated that gets. And so you've basically got instability now, again, that has been rife in D.C. over Kavanaugh's nomination since Christine Blasey Ford did come forward, but seemed to actually get resolved on Sunday, kind of fall apart again. And now we have Democrats saying we should have had an FBI investigation into Ford's allegations. We need to look into this stuff before we push ahead.
Well, let's talk about the Blasey Ford allegations. This was, as you mentioned, Kavanaugh's first accuser. She is set to testify on Thursday. And I want to play a clip from South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who is a member of the Judiciary Committee. And this was him on Fox News Sunday before the Deborah Ramirez article came out.
What am I supposed to do? Go ahead and ruin this guy's life based on an accusation. I don't know when it happened. I don't know where it happened. And everybody named in regard to being there said it didn't happen. I'm just being honest. Unless there's something more, no, I'm not going to ruin Judge Kavanaugh's life over this.
There's lots of talk about ruining lives, particularly in this era of the Me Too movement. Karin, what's your reaction to Graham's comments there?
Well, I'm not surprised that he made them. Lindsey Graham is at many points a straight shooter and just kind of says what everybody's thinking but doesn't want to say because it's not very diplomatic. There are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle, and I'm speaking of senators, who are not going to change their minds, who have already made up their minds about who's right and who's wrong, or at least about how they're going to vote on Kavanaugh's nomination, and nothing that happens Thursday is going to likely change that at all. This is all going to come down to a core group of moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans in the middle, some of whom were swayable before, perhaps a few more of whom are swayable now because of the shocking nature of the allegations that are coming out against Kavanaugh. But in the bigger picture, yeah, the question of life ruining has been in quite a football going back and forth, with people saying, look, the accused people have rights too, and by raising these allegations when you couldn't actually prove them in a court of law, you are keeping somebody from achieving what they might otherwise be able to achieve. The flip side of that is, of course, the trauma on the inflicted person who potentially, these are allegations, but if they are true, it says something about the severity of them, that it took a long time for them to come out. What about that style of life ruining? And that's the bigger conversation that we've been having all year, really, as we've been seeing women come out accusing powerful men of having sexually abused, harassed, any number of things, and having their reputations take the beating that they potentially deserved. Whether that's actually applicable in the circumstance, that remains to be seen, because these are allegations that will be vetted to some extent, at least on Thursday. But that's the social and the political environment in which this discussion about Kavanaugh is taking place.
Well, and also you mentioned, you know, I mean, these are allegations and these are not, we are not in a court of law. We're not discussing any criminal charges here. But this is essentially a job interview for one of the most important positions in this country. Why is it that Republicans are in such a rush to confirm this nominee? I mean, are they concerned that if Kavanaugh does not get confirmed, that they'll run out of time with the midterms right around the corner to get somebody else in the queue?
Well, that may now be another concern, given that there's additional allegations. There is not that much more time that Congress is supposed to be in Washington before the midterms come about. But look, Republicans have wanted to push ahead with Kavanaugh. He seemed to be somebody with a sterling reputation, much like Neil Gorsuch, who kind of sailed through and even got the votes of several Democrats for his nomination. But the longer this goes on, the more that Ford and others have time to try to substantiate their allegations, or at least convince senators that even if they can't prove it, that their gut is in the right place and that senators kind of just move over to finding them more credible, the more difficult it becomes to confirm Kavanaugh. And yes, the start of the Supreme Court session is in October. You want to be able to have somebody, if you are the president and his allies, to be able to have one of your picks that's on the bench at that point, because there's just some fairly important cases coming up. Also, Kavanaugh is fairly young, so you're talking about, you know, installing somebody who could turn the court fairly conservative for another generation. And, you know, he was the first pick in terms of the list of people that Trump said he would choose his Supreme Court nominees from. Going down the line, it could become more complicated to confirm others.
Has this process shaken Americans, the faith, if any, if whatever's left that Americans have had in our Supreme Court nomination process? I'm thinking more specifically because of some of the assumptions that not just folks in our Congress, but also the media has sort of assumed that this man will be confirmed, that Kavanaugh is a shoo-in. Has this actually shaken any of that? Has this actually had an impact on people maybe not assuming that he'll be confirmed?
Yeah, I think to some extent it has. I mean, look, again, when this first came out, it wasn't totally clear if it would affect him, but clearly Kavanaugh is, you know, to some extent doing his due diligence because he must be worried that this is not just going to roll away. Yeah, the confidence that was surrounding Kavanaugh is not ironclad anymore. I think it really depends on how things go Thursday, how each one of them performs. Because as much as this is going to come down to the case that they make, like we were discussing before, there isn't really enough factual evidence to prove this in a court of law, although you could still try. I mean, the statute of limitations in Maryland doesn't exist for this sort of crime, and so there potentially could be an attempt to prove that. But
well, that was going to be another question. Like, could Kavanaugh potentially face criminal charges at any point here? Because of the statute of limitations?
Potentially, but that depends on what Blasey Ford decides to do down the line, and that's not what's at issue for Thursday. What's at issue for Thursday is how are they both going to make their case? How are people going to feel watching them? How are senators going to kind of just judge in their feelings, in their gut, who is probably right here? And that's what's going to affect the votes in the short term. Because while Democrats have been arguing for, let's have the FBI investigate, and they could just do it in a few days, that's still probably not going to be the final arbiter of everything, because it has been so long and because you are going to have pushback from Kavanaugh's allies. It's not like it's going to all get magically resolved if the FBI looks into this. It will still come down to a question of how do people feel like they should be voting on this at the end, because if they get through Thursday and Kavanaugh stays in this nomination race, then there's eventually going to be a confirmation vote, and then it's just going to come down to a very close margin. But do enough Democrats and Republicans feel really uneasy about this, the ones in the middle are the ones I'm referring to, so that he can't quite break that threshold. And then that's a real serious message about, you know, how things have changed. The comparison is always 1991, Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas's confirmation process to get to the Supreme Court. Now, the facts are not exactly the same, but it's similar enough. And that the memory of having a woman sit in front of a all-male, all-white panel, and not the Democrat half is more diverse than that now, but the Republican half is that today as well, is just saying, look, have we come anywhere in 27 years? Of course, Republicans are saying that's really not a fair comparison. We should be judging it based on the merits, and they don't believe the merits are there to actually derail Kavanaugh's nomination.
Well, and the other issue, you know, you mentioned Anita Hill sitting there and testifying. I think, you know, there's obviously a question as well about race in that equation and what that brought up in the Anita Hill hearings. And my question to you, though, is given that history and given what's happening right now and given the context, the broader context around this Me Too movement, if you will, if Kavanaugh's confirmed, what could that potentially signal to American women?
That's the big question, right? Because we're talking about 2018 being the year of the woman again. And that's not just in terms of the number of female candidates who are running for office, but how are women going to vote? And what will they, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, if he's confirmed and everybody was very, very sensitive to Ford, okay, maybe that won't affect the vote too much. But if she ends up getting hammered unfairly, people feel, or they feel like the vote was kind of set up at the beginning. And again, it depends on how credible, how believable Ford ends up being, because the nation's going to be watching on Thursday. And that includes a lot of women voters who are considered a key swing block. How they feel about how this transpired could matter a lot in the midterm elections, which are right around the corner.
Karin Demirjian is a congressional reporter covering the judiciary for The Washington Post. Thanks, Karin.
Thank you.
On Friday, The Takeaway's Amy Walter spoke with Jenny Willoughby, the ex-wife of former White House staffer Rob Porter, who she says abused her emotionally and physically. Willoughby told us that going public with her story in the midst of a D.C. media storm allows her to relate to Dr. Ford and what she's going through.
I'm reliving it through what people are doing and saying about her. I'm reliving it watching the political pundits just make, in my opinion, really dehumanizing and insensitive comments as though she is some sort of political tool and not a human being who has been traumatized and who is upending her entire life in order to come forward and tell the truth.
We've also been hearing from many of you about your stories of coming forward after harassment or assault and what's at stake when deciding to do so.
I shared my experience with a sexual assault via Twitter. I was inspired by a disc jockey that was assaulted when he was really young. And like I said, it inspired me to finally say that it happened to me too.
My name is Laura, calling from Los Angeles. My story took place when I was 18. I was actually harassed and assaulted by the owner of the company that I worked for. I didn't tell anyone, including my close family, for a very long time. I was hoping to be able to advance and move forward in the company, and I knew that if I said anything, my chances of that would be slim to none. So I kept it to myself, and, you know, life goes on.
I'm Esther, calling from Dallas, and I shared my story with my family so I could get their support. I guess I risked my reputation in their eyes, but I also risked suffering in isolation, and I consider that a risk I was willing to take.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories. And if you'd like to weigh in, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. It's been about 5 months since I started with The Takeaway, and when I started thinking about the job, there were some themes that emerged for what I wanted to accomplish with this program. There were three gaps that I feel that we really need to work on in this country and in our media coverage, and they are the wealth gap, the truth gap, and the empathy gap. I talked about all of these a few weeks ago with two prominent activists at the Prosperity Summit in Washington, D.C., the feminist writer, thinker, and leader Gloria Steinem and the civil rights activist DeRay McKesson. And I want to play part of that conversation today because some of the most meaningful pieces of it were about sustaining hope and optimism as we struggle to close those gaps. I know a lot of Americans today are feeling discouraged as they think about social justice and civil rights and the future of our country. So what do we tell them about how to carry on while they fight for change? I asked DeRay and Gloria.
I would say the first thing I would do is listen to them. I mean, you know, because listening is maybe the most revolutionary thing we can possibly do. If just in the beginning we remember not to look up all the time, but look at each other, we'll be part of the way there. Because we all have, you know, friends and people who trust us and adversaries and things we can do internally. And I think part of the despair comes from a case of the shoulds. You know, what should I do, as opposed to every day getting up and thinking, I'm going to do everything I can, and I'm going to speak the truth, and I'm going to reach out to anybody who needs me in the moment, and take it from the bottom up instead of the top down.
I'd say two things come to mind. One is that the status quo thrives on people not believing that they have power. Like, that is one of the ways that, like, we get into the musical chairs with the status quo instead of actually changing the room. Is that people, one of the beautiful things about the protests is that in city and city and city, all of a sudden you found people who were like, I got it, right? Like, I have power, I get it, I can shut this down, I can speak this truth. Like, you saw people all over the country realize that they could do something different, and they always had the power, they just didn't know. Mm-hmm. So when I give people advice, it's like, you know that you have more power than you think. I think about being in the school system is that I used to manage all staffing, and this one parent one day, she emails and she's like, hey, my kid's classroom has 40 kids. It's like a first grade class. It's a lot of kids in first grade. And you know, we have 200 schools. I didn't hear that from a principal. I didn't hear from the teacher. I heard it from this random parent. Random parent emails the superintendent. Superintendent emails me. We literally redo the staffing in that elementary school because of this one random email. She'll never know it was her email that changed the staffing in the school, but it was it, right? Mm-hmm. And part of that is like her believing that like her voice actually mattered in some way. And like, I think that has to be a part of how we think about this.
How do we sustain movements? Black Lives Matter and a lot of the movement that came out of Ferguson, and feminism has had multiple waves and multiple, and so has the broader fight for civil rights. I remember a dark time in the 90s when feminism and civil rights were sort of not the issue in college campuses, unlike today. How do you sustain interest in a movement? I remember, you know, telling someone in college, well, there's a Center for Women's Concerns, and there was a joke about what women were concerned about, right, at the time. And yet today, every young woman that I know is proudly calling herself a feminist. And even going beyond that. And there's been this real embrace of Black Lives Matter and other civil rights politics. I wonder if we're going to see this level of sustained engagement, or will we have is this just an ebb and flow of movement building?
I think what helps us is to see the connections among all these things, right? All the movements and our aspirations are totally all connected. I mean, Trayvon Martin, okay. Zimmerman had been abusing women and had been convicted of abusing women before. If he had been interrupted in this habit, you know, it might have been different. As it was, even in his trial for murdering Trayvon Martin, that evidence was not admitted. So it's just an example of how these things are connected. That actually violence in the household, violence against females usually, but sometimes against men, certainly violence against kids, is the biggest predictor of all other violence, but we don't connect it. Our police force, for instance, has in general, police families have 4 times the rate of domestic violence that families in general have. If we address that, not to get rid of these guys, but to treat it, to understand it, to stop it, there would not be so much racist police violence either.
In general, I think about like the movement has to grow as people grow and vice versa, that has to be a part of the work. There was a point in my life where I literally like, I drove to Ferguson, didn't know anybody in the street. The first thing I ever did was make these amazing sandwiches in somebody's living room. Like, I quit my job, slept in the car on the side of the road, like all these things. And that was a point in my life where I was like, I could do it, I was ready to do that in that way. And now I'm in the world differently, and like the movement, there should still be place for all of us as we grow. So I think that is a part of it. You know, Cleo Wade, who's a mutual friend of both of ours, she always talks about activism is just organized storytelling. And part of what we have to do is like tell the story in a way that mobilizes people and creates on-ramps and off-ramps. It's why when I talk about the police, I believe we can live in a world without the police. I know that some people, that's just not the way to enter into the conversation with them. That like, if I start there, people are like, ah, and they're like, but what I say to them, I'll say things like, you know, in California, there's a law that literally says that any investigation of an officer that lasts more than a year can never result in discipline, regardless of the outcome. You can love the police and think that doesn't make sense, right? In Cleveland, the rule says that all officer disciplinary records are destroyed every 2 years. You can love the police And that don't make sense, right? 100 years ago, we were slitting people's wrists and letting them bleed out and calling that healthcare, and that was not a good solution. And I think that we're in a similar place with how we think about safety and policing today. But I get that, like, part of the choir is like finding like that hymn that people can hum first so they can learn how to sing later.
Should we, well, I'm sure I know your answer, DeRay, but should we be hopeful? And what gives us cause to be hopeful right now?
I know because of your podcast, even though we're just meeting for the first time today, that you too, like me, are a hopeaholic.
Hopeaholic.
Right? Okay, so, because hope is a form of planning. You know, if your hopes weren't real inside you, you couldn't even hope them.
Right.
So what, to not to be hopeful is to be defeated immediately. It's that hope and vision of what could be, even if it's 5 minutes from now, or, you know, if it's 5 years, or whatever it is, that gives us the strength to proceed toward it. So, you know, do I know what's going to happen? No, I don't know what's going to happen. But some, I mean, hope is absolutely crucial. And we so need younger people because they are mad as hell because they know it should be better, right? So, you know, it's just hope is a vision of what you're going to do the next day and the next and what this person might respond. And I'm all for hopeaholism, and I'm so grateful that that both you're angry and you're hopeful. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'd say simply, I'm proud to be in a community of so many people who are ready to do something about the things in the world. And I think about being on the stage today, it's like, what does it mean to not live in somebody's shadow, but to live in their glow? Mm. And I think that that is like the best of what we can do with each other.
Gloria Steinem is a prominent feminist author and activist, and DeRay McKesson is an author and civil rights activist whose new book is called On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. And you can find video of our entire conversation from the 2018 Prosperity Summit on our website, thetakeaway.org.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Over the weekend, the Trump administration announced it would take another significant step in cutting back on legal immigration. The Department of Homeland Security wants to restrict green cards for any immigrant who legally accepts public benefits like food assistance or Section 8 housing. Leon Fresco is an immigration attorney and former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department, and he was also head of the Office of Immigration Litigation under the Obama administration. Leon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So let's talk a little bit about this rule, which, by the way, is not short. It's about 447 pages long. What's in all of those pages?
Well, in any rule, you have an explanation, an executive summary, an economic impact statement, and a lot of other things that aren't the exact rule. But the thrust of the rule itself is a new definition of what constitutes benefits that can be counted against non-citizens when they apply for either an extension of their immigration status, initial entry into the country, or adjustment of their status into green cards, with what is known as the public charge ground of inadmissibility, which is one of the first grounds from 100 years ago that was invented in the immigration law, which was a ground of inadmissibility that was designed to say that if the government believed that you were going to be dependent upon the public financial fisc for assistance, that you could be ruled inadmissible and not be allowed to live in the United States legally. And basically, the way the system has been up until now is if you're getting a benefit legally and that benefit is available to people in your immigration status or category, that wouldn't be held against you in any future immigration application. What's changing now is there's a much more tightening status to say, hey, even if a state or a locality or the federal government says a certain benefit is eligible, that you're eligible for a certain benefit, it still won't matter. You will still be held to be inadmissible, or you won't be allowed to extend your stay here or to get a green card because you've taken that.
This strikes me as another example of very targeted discrimination towards a specific group. In this case, I would say brown immigrants in this country. Am I wrong with that? Or
well, what I would say is this. I think there is there's a systematic approach generally that this administration is taking, that it's trying to reduce all immigration into the United States, legal and illegal. And so this is yet another way to try to disqualify as many people as possible from obtaining legal immigration status, is to say, if you've taken any benefit, even, by the way, from a state or a locality, and those could be places that want to welcome immigrants and recognize their contribution and say, please take certain benefits so that you can get your situation in order, and then you can expand out and become people who pay even more into the system than what you took in. Even those will be counted against people for their immigration status. So, I mean, it's targeting. You'd be shocked how many people fall under this. So it's not just brown immigrants or black. It's a lot of people will be falling into this basket of people who've collected one benefit or another in some shape or form at some period of time.
And let's talk about how big that basket is. I mean, you said it could affect people who are seeking green cards in general. How could that happen?
Correct. So what happens is, and this is something people don't realize, is when you're first coming into the United States and you go to an embassy to apply for a visa, the consular officer has sort of carte blanche authority to decide, to just look at you and say, I think you're going to be a public charge. And so this new rule actually says if that officer decides to do that based on a 60 to 90 second assessment of you, they can even charge you a bond that you'd have to pay in order to come into the United States, that would say, here's this bond, and if you can't pay it, too bad. And all of this is sort of subjective and is not really based on anything of actual substance. And so there's a lot of different things that this 400-page rule does, but all of it meant to shrink the funnel of people coming in or staying in the United States.
Leon Fresco is an immigration attorney who worked in the Justice Department in the Obama administration. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Tanzina.
After years or decades in prison, what are the first things a newly freed person might notice about their new world?
When you come out after a long period of time, shoes hurt your feet. You're not used to wearing shoes.
When I took my first bath, I felt like a coward. When I sat down, I felt vulnerable.
The bathroom? It flushed by itself. What?
Those are some of the older men involved with the New York City-based Fortune Society making the transition from prison to the outside world. And we'll hear more of their stories later this week. Because for the next few days, The Takeaway is looking at life after prison and some of the challenges people who are newly released can face. Today, we're starting with that very moment when a prisoner is released back into the world, the moment when a person becomes free. You might have a few dollars and the clothes on your back, and if you're lucky, your family will be there to get you. But for many people, there's nothing but fear.
You feel nervous. You feel what's on the other side. It was all kind of like this picture that you can only imagine.
Carlos Cervantes was released in 2011, and for the last 5 years, he's worked with the Ride Home program. Cervantes meets people right when they're released from state prison in California, and he helps them get coffee, a meal, some fresh clothes, and is with them in those very first few hours as they reemerge into the outside world. And after that, what comes next? Michael Romano is one of the founders of the Ride Home program and founder of the Three Strikes Project at Stanford Law School. And he joins us to talk about the first moments, days, and weeks prisoners face when they start the next chapters of their lives. Michael, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about this program. Why did you start this, and what was the need that you were trying to solve for?
The Ride Home Project began when we were working on reforms out here in California to California's Three Strikes Law. And there were a large number of people who were being released from prison rather suddenly after serving 10 and 20 years for nonviolent crimes. And, well, it turns out that people who are released from prison in California can be released hundreds of miles away from where they're supposed to be paroled to. So, for example, you could be in prison all the way up near the Oregon border and need to report back to your parole agent down in San Diego or Los Angeles. And in California, and this is true actually many places around the country, you're given about $100 and a bus ticket and told to make your way home. So fairly early on in this reform process, when people were being released from prison, we were introduced to a few unbelievable, truly unbelievable guys who had been in prison themselves, who had spent a considerable amount of time in prison and now were out and had put their lives together, had reconnected with their family and were working and were really doing outstanding work. And we hired them actually to go pick up our clients and be their ride home and be their first contact with the free world and buy them their first meal as a free person, go to Target or Walmart and buy their first shampoo and deodorant and new underwear, and then bring them to their reentry housing program. So we were really a bridge from that, you know, those crucial first moments of being released from prison, having met somebody at the prison gates, to a long-term housing program.
And what are some of the things that people who are just released from prison have to adjust to that those of us who haven't been in prison or we just sort of live our daily lives might take for granted?
Sure. This is something that we didn't really anticipate either. So many times we were just overwhelmed with the kind of micro barriers that people have to reintegrating to society. So, for example, sometimes our clients are unaccustomed to even opening a door because for 20 years they've been in prisons where the doors to their cells or their doors between buildings, you know, open and close automatically for them. Or they're unaccustomed to ordering food off of menu. I remember one of my clients who I picked up, and he had served 24 years of a life sentence under the three strikes law for extraordinary minor crime, petty theft. And I went to pick him up, and I went with one of our students, and we met him at the gates. And we said, you know, where do you want to go? Where do you want to have your first meal? And even that choice was very overwhelming. And well, anyway, we were able to drill down, and he liked barbecue, and we went to a barbecue place not far away. And I ordered a big basket of French fries for the table, and we were having a pretty good time, I think. And this guy's name is Will. I think he was a little bit overwhelmed and a little quiet, but you know, we were really beginning to settle in and decompress a little bit. And at the end of the meal, I noticed that Will hadn't had any French fries, and I said, "Well, Will, you know, have some fries." And and he didn't even realize that we could share French fries, especially between people of different races. And, you know, this is an in-prison rule that is, you know, sacrosanct, that people don't touch each other's food, especially people of different races. And I'm white and Will is black. And it was just something that I had absolutely no idea about. I was just trying to be a magnanimous host and order a bunch of food and that we'd all share it down at the table. And, you know, this is on top of the other obvious barriers to reentry, like finding a job, having stable housing, being able to vote, that a lot of other organizations focus on. And we found that these micro barriers in the very first days and hours and sometimes even minutes of getting out can be the most overwhelming. And it's something that we're able to help folks get over.
And do you ever extend any of these relationships beyond that first day out?
Sure. What is something that is pretty amazing is that our clients are able to get cell phones and become very avid texters and social media consumers. That comes amazingly quickly to folks who've been released from prison. And so I'm in pretty regular contact with many, if not most, of our clients. I would say, and then we help them with other legal barriers and issues that they might face regarding, you know, where do they go to their parole office and how do they arrange to pay for their restitution and certain things like that. But really, it's kind of these socializing pieces that I hope are the most valuable. And our ride home drivers, the folks who do this much more often than I do, have a whole stable of people actually all across the country that they keep in, you know, very regular contact with. And some more than others. Like I said, some run into legal problems that we help them sort out. And then, you know, some are able to really do incredibly well and succeed and don't need our support. So it varies, but yes, we are in touch with them.
Michael Romano is the co-founder of the Ride Home program. Michael, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.